And welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. You can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com, and you can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. Programs like In Context are made possible by the generous contributions of listeners like you that keep non-commercial WPKN independent and strong. Thanks very much to those listeners who donated during WPKN's recent on-air pledge drive, and you can still make a tax-deductible donation to WPKN simply by visiting our website, WPKN.org. Thanks for your support. With me in the studio are In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott-Rowe.
Good afternoon.
And our guest commentator, Del LaPietro.
Hello.
Del hosts his own show on WPKN, and when can people listen to that show, Del?
Second, fourth, and fifth Fridays, 7 to 9, prime time, drive time.
All right. And we'll be opening the phones in just a few minutes, but let's start off by looking at some of the important recent news. Marshawn, North Korea just announced that it's tearing up the 60-year-old armistice that stopped the Korean War. And a listener should remember that in the Korean War, the U.S. fought China directly. It wasn't just between North Korea and South Korea, but the U.S. had an army there, and so did China. So, Marshawn, what's going on with North Korea?
Well, I think the first thing we have to look at, in order to understand what's going on with the Korean Peninsula now, we have to understand how the Korean Peninsula became the way it is today, how it became to be divided. And I think this is an obscure part of Korean history, because most people are very familiar with the Korean War, but most people aren't quite sure exactly how it began. So, I mean, the Korean Peninsula was split in 1945 between a Soviet zone of occupation and an American zone of occupation near the end of the war in 1945, right before the atomic bombs were dropped. The Soviet Union went to war with the United States. And, I mean, I'm sorry, not with the United States, sorry, am I... Headphones are acting up a little bit. The Soviet Union went to war with Japan.
Right. The Soviets were hoping to make their... they were hoping to get into Asia. They were hoping that by coming to the war at the end, they could stake out some prime real estate. Okay, but in any event, this artificial division was set up by the United States at the end of World War II.
Well, originally, what the Soviets were hoping to do was establish a Soviet zone of occupation throughout the Far East. Eventually, their goal was to invade Japan as well before the United States could. So it was part of the early stages of the Cold War. The Soviets knew that eventually we were going to be out of the picture. And so the Soviet Union declares war on Japan. They take over Manchuria. They take over the northern half of Korea. The United States takes over and liberates the southern half of Korea. They meet much the same way they did in Eastern Europe. You know, Soviet soldiers met the Americans. We all shook hands, and you know, the evil empire of Japan and Germany were both defeated. Well, then the issue became, well, how are we going to govern this? So there was an agreement originally that both sides, we divided Soviet and American zone of occupation, but then there was going to be a joint elections held in the two zones and a unity government. And the agreement between the Soviets and the Americans was that Korea would become unified. Well, the Soviets established a communist puppet regime in North Korea called the Democratic People's Republic, led by Kim Il-sung, who was a veteran of the wars in China against the Japanese. And a very charismatic young man, very, very trustworthy. And in the South, the Americans put in a very right-wing Syngman Rhee, who was a very trusted anti-communist. So, you know, automatically it became, in a sense, it developed into the two Koreas almost...
The South being the surrogate for the U.S., the North being the surrogate for Russia.
Exactly. In spite of the fact that the original plan was to unite the two Koreas, it really developed
into... So it was a front line for the Cold War. As soon as the Cold War started, there you go.
Exactly. And so what then you start to have happening is cross-border clashes, communist revolts in the South, people who oppose Syngman Rhee's authoritarian kind of rule, because also Syngman Rhee employed a lot of they were Koreans, but they had served in the Japanese army. So a lot of ex-Japanese imperial soldiers in South Korea in his constabulary. So you had a lot of communists revolting in the South. Then on the other hand, in the North, you had a lot of anti-communists revolting who said, well, hang on, we don't want to go swing to this extreme of, you know, this Stalinist-style system. We want a socialist system. We don't want Stalinists. So the two Koreas developed into extremist states, an extremist right-wing government in the South and extremist left-wing government in the North. And you had guerrillas fighting both. And then you eventually had each side sending its own guerrillas across the border. And this kind of tit-for-tat, along with cross-border clashes, continued until 1950, when the North Korean army just opens fire on the South. Now, mind you, the United States this entire time was completely ignoring the Korean issue because all eyes were focused on Eastern Europe and on the Soviets might invade West Germany, they might invade Western Europe. You know, all eyes were on the West, especially at the time of the Berlin airlift. So what you're seeing is very similar to today. All eyes right now are on Iran, and we're completely blowing off North Korea. So there's a similar pattern here. The other thing that you saw that was analogous to today was the fact that the United States was withdrawing its troops from Korea. We said, well, you know, we've left some advisors. South Koreans can handle it. So the North Koreans saw a golden opportunity, and they launched a massive artillery barrage on the South. And
this is 1950
and invaded South Korea. And what you had happen is the United States was taken aback because we went, oh my gosh, you know, Korea's much more important than we thought. And General MacArthur had actually been advocating with Washington saying, hey, listen, Asia is going to be the new theater of operations in the Cold War. Asia is going to be incredibly important. And like I say, Truman kind of blew him off and said,
and of course, he was the World War II commander in the Pacific.
Exactly. MacArthur was. Exactly. Yes. And so MacArthur saw the importance of Asia. The White House didn't. So the war breaks out, and all of a sudden there's panic mode sets in at the White House. They go, oh my gosh, the communists are making a move. So they called up the reserve. They mobilized every soldier they could from Japan to California, and they started shipping them into Korea. Well, the war went badly for the U.S. from the very beginning, and the United Nations forces, because the war against North Korea was fought under the flag of the United Nations. Security Council voted, and with the Soviet Union abstaining, because the Soviet Union actually walked out.
So it was nominally a UN war but most of the troops were Americans.
Most of the troops were Americans and British. Although you had you had thousands of Turkish soldiers, South Africans. You had some French, some Swedish. There were a lot of other countries, but the majority were actually American and British. The third largest would have been the Turks. So we enter the scene, and it wasn't until MacArthur's landing a few months later at Incheon, at the port of Incheon, which was into North Korean-occupied territory, that we threw the North Koreans back. We launched an offensive, and we pushed them all the way up. We took Pyongyang, pushed them all the way up to the Yalu River, which was the border with China, and we thought, well, the war's over, we're almost done, we've won. Well, the Chinese communists, which had taken over in China, defeated the nationalists. Mao and his cadre are looking at the situation, they're going, oh, geez, you know, if we let Korea fall, which is traditionally a Chinese satellite, we're looking at losing the first battle of the Cold War. The first battle of the Cold War is going to be a victory for capitalism. So the Chinese send 500,000 volunteers, quote unquote, across the border. Now, you do have to, this has to be present in people's minds that the Chinese are masters of doublespeak. They will say one thing and do the complete opposite. When their soldiers, 500,000, and eventually throughout the course of the war, the Chinese sent over 1.5 million to Korea. One of the things that you have to look at is the Chinese on the one hand say, well, you know, this is kind of an internal struggle. They tell the UN, look, we just want recognition. We just want recognition from the UN. We don't really want to get involved in Korea. Then 1.5 million Chinese volunteers are found to be in Korea. And we say, well, China, what are you doing about this? And the Chinese go, well, they're volunteers. They're not Chinese soldiers. We can't stop volunteers. And then, you know, MacArthur saw what was really going on. MacArthur said, look, we got to bomb China. The Chinese are directly involved. And again, the White House says, well, no, let's, you know, now we just came off the heels of World War II. This is President Truman. We just came off the heels of World War II. We really don't want to get involved in a war with China. But the fact is, and we're making, again, the same mistake today. The Chinese come over and they say, well, we condemn these nuclear detonations. Where do you think they got the science to develop these nuclear bombs from? China.
So there was the Korean War that you've been describing began in 1950, did end in 1953 without a permanent peace, but with something called an armistice, right?
Well, exactly.
So there's technically still a state of war, which is the backdrop between these North and South, which is the backdrop for this discussion that we're coming up to now, which is China's attitude towards Korea and this UN sanction against North Korea.
Well, what's very important to understand about the armistice is that, first of all, South Korea didn't sign the armistice. They didn't sign the armistice originally. South Korea, under President Syngman Rhee, actually refused to sign the armistice with North Korea. So, because President Syngman Rhee believed that the war should continue to be prosecuted until North Korea is liberated, and like I say, the Americans had enough, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that at this point the Eisenhower administration was looking at the wider picture, and they said, "Look, if we can just break even right now,"
which we'll essentially be what would ended up with a stalemate. It went back to the status quo ante.
What's very important is that for the South Koreans, the war never ended between South Korea and North Korea.
Right.
They signed a truce with the UN forces, which includes us, but South Korea didn't sign, and so, technically speaking, the North and South are still at war. And what's very important for people to understand is that when North Korea talks about tearing up the truce, they're talking about tearing up the truce they have with the United States and the UN forces in South Korea. So,
And what's bringing this to a head today is North Korea's continuing testing of its nuclear bomb. And our suspicions that they're developing a good missile delivery system, which we don't know if it can reach the United States or not yet. Some say it can't. Some say it can't. But as a result of this developments, we have orchestrated these severe UN sanctions. And as I understand it, the United States can stop ships headed towards North Korea, which would normally be illegal. But under the UN sanctions, we can now stop ships headed to North Korea, which is pretty close to getting close to war, I would think.
Absolutely. Well, and the reason why the North Koreans are becoming so aggressive, first of all, their detonations of the nuclear devices and their testing of this rocket. What's very important to understand is North Korea has always been very bellicose, very loud and obnoxious, and they've always said, you know, we will turn Seoul into a sea of fire. Nobody ever took them seriously because they never did it. But what's very important to understand is North Korea has fired 3 or 4 rockets. They've all landed in the ocean, totally unsuccessful. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the North Koreans launch a successful missile into space. They put up a satellite, quote-unquote, into space. Now, one of the things that's very... I did air quotes there. One of the things that's very important to understand about this, though, is the fact that after failure, suddenly they are massively successful in launching this missile into space. This didn't happen by accident. We also, our intelligence estimates, which shows how little we know about what's actually going on in Korea, our intelligence estimates said they wouldn't be able to put a missile into space for another 10 years. Suddenly they did it, overnight.
So how do you think they got that far advanced, would you say?
I absolutely think it has to do with the Chinese. The Chinese see an opportunity. North Korea's always been their proxy. And I think right now they see an opportunity to push the U.S. out of Asia, especially with, in terms of, you're looking at this this sequester, you're looking at the massive cuts in the U.S. military, in spite of all of our bellicose rhetoric, you know, we can repel the North Koreans, we would destroy them. Everybody knows we're decommissioning a carrier battle group. We're cutting our active duty force to less than 500,000. I mean, we don't have money to provide bullets. I was reading in the Army Times recently that Marines at Camp Lejeune are sitting on the range and they're going, butter, butter, jam, butter, butter, jam.
Is that, you know, that really hurts the target.
Oh, yeah, you know, the butter, butter, jam. Especially, it's clever, too, butter and jam.
So the Chinese are playing at both sides. Publicly, they're all behind, at the UN, they're behind the sanctions against North Korea. North Korea is a rogue, you know, and they've got to be controlled. But behind the scenes, are they probably still buddy-buddy with the North Koreans?
They have to be, because China supplies North Korea with all of its food, electricity, weapons, I mean, and money. If China was sincere and said, we want to stop North Korea, they would threaten to cut the supply of electricity, food, water, and money, and the country would capitulate overnight. But the fact is, what the Chinese want to do is they want a war. They want to push
us out
of
Asia. So this
could
quickly blow up into this whole Korean situation, into a war between China and the United States, as occurred in the early 1950s during the Korean War. So this time, China's a lot more formidable.
Absolutely. Well, and the Chinese have even said, I mean, like a lot of this, it's an open secret. The Chinese have said in their own white papers, and in fact, the chief of staff of the Chinese Military Academy said the number one enemy of China is the United States, and every plan on paper for China is for war with the United States. And so, I mean, it's almost madness for us to just ignore this and say, well, China must really be worried. Because occasionally I see these pundits on Fox, and my favorite is Katie McFarland. She says, well, you know, I think we've really intimidated the Chinese. I think they're really stepping up. They don't want to see a rogue nation with nuclear weapons. I'm thinking, are you insane? North Korea, we also thought, couldn't test another nuclear bomb for at least 5 years. Suddenly, within a few months of testing the last one, they did another one. So, I mean, clearly they're getting this technology from somewhere else. And I read an interesting article in the Times of Israel, which was speculating that the reason why these nuclear detonations are so small is that they're not designed to be like, you know, Hiroshima-type nuclear bombs. What they're testing is an EMP bomb, which operates off the same principle.
Are we pretty confident the Russians and the Chinese have EMP bombs?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
And the EMP bomb, for those of us who haven't heard us describe in the previous shows, is a bomb that can be detonated high in the atmosphere and basically renders inoperable all of your electronic equipment.
What it is it's a nuclear device. It is a nuclear bomb, but it requires a much less intensity of a payload. So, for example, you can have a relatively small nuclear device detonate in the atmosphere, and it sends down a very strong electrical pulse.
Shuts down everything. It shuts down. That's what it does.
Exactly. Just
even if it's for a brief time, then you have reset of whatever things are out there.
Exactly. You know? But that brief time could allow you to achieve air superiority, could allow you to launch a first strike. And by the time everything restarts up again, even if it's only a 24-hour period, be enough time for your forces to gain a significant momentum. And of course, it'd be incredibly demoralizing for the people who are hit. And so that's why the Times of Israel has been speculating. The Russians and the Chinese have this technology. That was in Popular Mechanics had a great article on it. And so the Russians and the Chinese also, they wouldn't want to see a nuclear strike. Wouldn't make a whole lot of sense because it would
baby steps, my friend. Baby steps.
Yeah. Exactly.
And if you contaminate your target, what good is that?
And even if they're not planning on occupying us, the problem would be that their missile can. So what they believe now is because they put the rocket up into space, all they need is just to have a hardened tip of the missile, and they can have reentry capabilities. The problem is that if the missile reenters from the atmosphere, in theory, we might have enough time to shoot it down. But if the thing comes down from the atmosphere and detonates in the atmosphere, raining down this electromagnetic pulse, we would never get a chance to shoot it down. It would detonate too high for us to actually hit it, and it could, in theory, according to Popular Mechanics, it was, three of these devices could wipe out, two to three, could wipe out the entire United States electrical grid. Because virtually nothing in the United States is hardened, least of all in our military and emergency services, hardened against an EMP strike.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In Context is WPKN's live public affairs call-in show. We've been talking about recent development, a very important recent development, which is North Korea's threat, actually, they threatened a preemptive strike against the United States. They've said that they're going to end the armistice, which ceased the fighting between North and South Korea in 1953. And we're talking about the close relationship between China and North Korea and the prospect that a new Korean War would lead to a confrontation, a devastating war between the United States and China. And one of the recurring themes of In Context is to make you listeners aware of the consequences of our long policy of military expansion. It really began in 1991 with our invasion of the Persian Gulf, so we're in our third decade of this military expansion, that it's bringing us into conflict with two rising military giants, Russia and China. And we have to be aware of the risk we're running if we continue this policy of military expansion. And so on the show, we also not only track the expansion, but we carefully look at the military capabilities of our principal rivals, Russia and China.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, military expansion or not, the thing is that the countries that were destined to always be adversaries of the United States, regardless of if we were totally isolationist or not, were always going to be, especially the Chinese. The Russians, to an extent, so long as we had any stake in Western Europe, Russia was going to be our adversary. And so long as we have any stake in Asia, China is going to be our adversary.
Japan before them.
Can I interject a question?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What do you think the effect of students that come across here, learn technology, learn our ways, get really educated, go back to their homelands, and then have these ideas of expanding their gain, their dictatorships, if you will? We've seen it time and time again.
Oh, Absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest problems is that, in addition to the fact that there's a total brain drain from the United States.
The folks in Iran aren't stupid. The folks over in North Korea with Kim Jong-un, who's Dennis Rodman's latest playmate.
Oh, yeah. This is a
hell of a thing. So these people get educated over here and go back to their homeland and do what? Are now threatening our livelihood.
And we know
right?
that they're penetrating our computer systems and
well,
stealing as
and
much,
that's how they learned how to do
right.
it. Because Chinese
right.
students come over here. And I'm not saying that all Chinese
no,
students are
merely
are spies,
posing the question that people should be aware of this. It's been going on in a lot of high-tech companies for years. They come over, whoever they is, all right? I'm not disadvocating a race or a nation or any of that stupid stuff. The point is, people come over here on the visas, and they learn their trade. They get precedence because they go out and get jobs, cheap wages. They cut out American jobs. They get educated, and they go back to their merry ways, and some do us harm. Some mean to do us harm.
It makes espionage a whole lot easier, because it would surprise me was when you look at even influential scientists in Iran, how many are MIT educated? Or even
so, the question of the day and the participation in, because we got a phone call in show at 203-336-9756. What do you think our topic should be for today? What do you want to hear from people? Do we cover the student thing of it? Do we say the general Kim Jong-il is, I say ill, as opposed to Un, because the guy's definitely got a screw loose. Should we be taking this guy seriously, or we're just going to be...
And that call-in number again is 203-336-9756. You're welcome to join the conversation. 203-336-9756. My name is Ken. I'm here with Marchand and Dell. And we're talking right now about China and the prospects of a war with China and Chinese rise in the world economically. There's a very interesting book, it's not a new one, so about 25 years old, about the rise and fall of the great empires by Paul Kennedy. And we are following the same pattern of all the previous empires. We are hollowing out our economy while our adversaries overtake us.
Well, and I think that's definitely one of the major problems we have also is our ignoring of defense. I mean, I think we have...
Okay.
There are a lot of similarities that we can see between us and previous civilizations and previous superpowers. But I think one of the biggest problems we face, and that other superpowers have historically faced, is that we are ignoring dangers and threats. You know, as Dell very poignantly asked, he said, you know, should we take Kim Jong-un seriously? And to be honest, you know, one of the things we're doing is we're saying, well, he's just like his father, he's bellicose, he's loud, obnoxious, we can ignore him. But the fact is, we're not looking at the fact that, A, he's a different man. He was educated in Switzerland, so he knows the West. His father was a provincial. His father never left the country. But Kim Jong-un was educated in Switzerland. He knows the West. He knows how we think, how we operate. He didn't grow up in the Hermit Kingdom.
Yes.
And so we also tend to ignore the stakes of other superpowers in Korea as well, and in the region as a whole. We tend to take, you know, the Chinese at face value. We take the Russians at face value. We don't look for ulterior motives, you know. And so I think that poses a huge problem for us.
And we have Mary on the line. Mary, you with us?
I am.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
Great.
And what's on your mind?
Okay, basically, I agree with everything that you guys are saying. Recently, I had my account compromised, and someone was trying to take about $5,600 out of my checking account. And I never did any trade with anybody for them to get this information. And at the same time, when my account was being compromised, my computer crashed. So they searched it down through the bank, and the bank protected our fees, which is a good thing, but nobody ever gets to the bottom of finding out who these people are.
And who are they?
It came to be a company out of China who is a legitimate company, so it not necessarily means the company owner, but it could be someone that works there. It could be a number of things.
So did they trace it to a server in China, or did they say this was definitely a Chinese company that hacked into your stuff?
Well, they have no idea who did it, but the company they were trying to buy from was a legitimate business, okay? So how it got hacked is very disturbing, because myself, I do not do anything online to make it short and quick. I don't make anything online with credit cards unless they have the secure website, you know, the secure box on the bottom where it'll tell you it's a secure site and everything's protected and all that.
Who do you bank with? Do you mind us asking?
Bank of America.
Okay. BOA. Thank you. Well, and this is, tell me, has this happened more than once? Do you mean other people that this has happened with?
In the past 5 years, it has happened 3 times to me.
Wow.
It has happened several times to other people that I know. And the only
Have them call in and tell us that.
Right.
It would be nice.
The only thing that I trade or do business with is going on eBay. But you're paying with a secured site when you do it that way. And you would think, one would think that's a secure site. But
maybe.
When I presented it to the bank, he told me the number one hot spot for people is going to get gas at a gas station and swiping your card, your debit credit card. He said that the hackers have a way to put a device on the bottom of the machine. Nobody even knows about it. Or they have so much technology that they have a machine that just goes over the swiping machine and takes all the information out of it.
It's called a sniffer.
Right. There you go.
And you can do it remotely now if you're in the area. Like, all you got to do is go buy the thing if you have the right technology and you have smarts about you. But, yeah, that's kind of interesting, the Chinese connection. It's happened more than once. I mean, even Craigslist used to be legitimate at one time. Now that's a laughing stock, you know, because of all the illegitimate people that use that site. So why not somebody like eBay?
Well, I mean, you know what?
Hackers are hackers, you know.
Right, and the kids have to be aware of PlayStation because I've heard people that I know that their kids would go online and play with other kids, which you would think is a harmless thing, but you don't know who you're talking to on the other end.
That's the thing, too, is that there's lots of kids that do this internet thing through other gaming things, but that doesn't mean somebody can't look at the other end and look into their gaming device, which is on their hard drive, blah, 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 and there it goes.
Yes.
You know.
And one of the interesting things I find is that, you know, there really nothing on the internet, none of our hardware is really truly secure. I mean, you have that little lock, that little symbol which says, you know, this is a secure site. But the fact is the Chinese were caught hacking into the Department of Justice. There was an article on the Army Times which said that the Chinese government, an actual Chinese army wing, was caught hacking into into the military CAC card readers, the military ID readers, which
there you go.
That infamous white building that's 8 stories high.
Exactly.
There you go.
You know, so it's,
you know, their intelligence is, this is all they do. This is their main function in life.
Sure,
they
pick up the free information.
They are superior in certain avenues, and it's a detriment to us. If everybody was to get along and everybody was using it to help everybody progress in life, it'd be a different story. But there's always that mystery, and there's always that idea that, wow, I look at all the money I can make if I do this. And
well, there's always an evil element to anything. So we appreciate you calling in. We'll call you Mary.
And thanks so much.
Please
Mary
encourage other people to call in if they've had this problem. I mean, call back anytime during this
noon
to 1 hour. Right?
Absolutely.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you for introducing this idea. You need to do this more often because people have to be aware. Because people just put it to the wayside.
Thanks
Mary.
For calling
Thank
in.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering, Marshawn, how could we dial back this whole confrontation with Russia and China? Because not only are we talking about the risk to us of an attack, but we're also having to deal with the intrusiveness of our own government on our lives. Now, the Supreme Court, for example, in a 5-4 decision, just struck down a broad-based challenge to the government's warrantless wiretapping. I mean, ever since 9/11, the government's been jumping all over our civil rights with illegal wiretaps. We've got the president signing this NDAA, this National Defense Authorization Act, which gives him the power to put American citizens indefinitely in military prisons. We've got him claiming the authority to assassinate U.S. citizens. Yeah, assassinate U.S. citizens. How do we dial back here so we can be
secure? You filibuster for 13 hours like Rand Paul did. get his answer.
There you go. Well, maybe we'll
talk
about
thing.
That.
That was kind of interesting.
That's a very interesting debate. Which
one of the biggest topics of the week, by the way.
Was the drone. The background is John Brennan, who has been nominated. It was then confirmed by substantial vote in the Senate as the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, has long been a big advocate of the use of drones. And, of course, President Obama has been greatly expanding the use of drones and claims the right to assassinate anybody, including an American citizen who suspects of being a terrorist without the benefit of due process, right? And Rand Paul said this is wrong, and he's for those who don't know, he's the son of Ron Paul and a senator from Kentucky. He conducted a filibuster in opposition to the confirmation of John Brennan as a way of protesting the use of drones by the U.S. president as for assassinations. So what do you think of that, Marshawn?
Well, I mean, if I understand your question correctly, again, I'm a technical guy, so I really don't have whether assassinating Americans is right or wrong. I mean, it does sound a little funky, but, you know, that's what goes on in every other country on the world. You know, they in places like Russia and China. But
well, I'll go on record saying that it's wrong to assassinate Americans.
I'm a technical guy. You right. can have opinion. I can't.
I understand.
But because my job is just to deal with facts alone. And I think one of the things that when you look at this is that we're completely focusing on the drones clearly shows that we are more frightened of a domestic uprising, of a domestic insurgency, domestic terrorists, than we are the real threat of Russia and China. And the historical basis mm-hmm. for this is Stalin's Russia, because Stalin was more frightened of the kulaks, the middle class and bourgeois Russians, than he was of the Nazis. And at the end, that resulted in Russia
getting
invaded.
So here we see the vast expansion of the Homeland Security Department with over a billion, they bought over a billion rounds of high power ammo. At the same time, they're cutting back on the active duty military. We have a phone call.
Jeff from Easton is on the line now. I think you had passed and went on to something else. Jeff, did you want to say something?
Yeah, what do we know about that pilot that reported a drone? You know, while he's in midair.
That was the Alitalia pilot a few days ago reported a drone in the vicinity of JFK Airport. I think he said it was 4 to 5 miles away. I think it was over Brooklyn. And the FBI has investigated, and they claim they haven't a clue as to where this drone came from. What do you think, Jeff?
Well, so I thought I read that that drone was 200 feet from the plane.
Maybe it was. The pilot estimated it was 4 to 5 miles from the airport, but it was right near the. Apparently, it was right near the plane there.
Oh, okay. So, you know, was that drone? Are our drones marked with any countries' markings like we used to mark the fighter planes, or is that just a black drone that was launched from a Chinese or Russian vessel of some sort?
Very interesting question.
You know, was it dropped out of another? Could you drop a drone out of another aircraft? Or, well, I guess just like the space shuttle, could you have just dropped it from some other plane, even high up in the air? You know,
those are really good questions.
Like the Blackbird would fly, drop this thing in there. It's a Chinese, and so were you just literally just testing the defenses? Could we see it? Do we know that it was there? Do we know where it came from? Do we know what it was doing? And maybe it was nothing more than just a test. But while we spend all this money, and I always make this point, while we spend all this money fighting, and on one side you guys say, you know, we're not worried about the defense, we're hollowing out the country. At the end of the day, every climate report says the same thing. Your planet's melting, but we still want to fight war. At what point does the planet melt and we go, gee, maybe we shouldn't have spent all that money?
Yeah, right.
Let's hope it never gets that bad.
We're fiddling while Rome burns, right?
But it is that bad. You look at the crazy weather we've had, and you've still got all these people who are spending more time fighting people who claim that the climate hasn't changed.
And we've experienced that right here in Fairfield, right in our risking area.
Right. Yeah. How many Sandys do we have to have every year before we go, you know, maybe our dollars better be spent somewhere else? It is a crazy mixed-up world with 7 billion people. You know, I don't know which battle you should fight. I mean, if I was a president, I'd tell the Chinese and North Koreans one more step on which state do we vaporize first, and then can have a discussion. Because if you're going to sit on all those weapons and not plan to use them, what's the point of having them? I mean, the idea that North Korea should think that they could hold us hostage, it's like after we vaporize North Korea, Beijing. Do you want Beijing or Shanghai next?
Well, we want to be killing too many people. Well, innocents, that is. Thanks for your call, Stephen. We have another listener. We have somebody else on the line.
Oh, thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for calling. I'm not bombing either country, but at the same time, anyway, thanks.
Thank you,
thanks,
Jeff.
I appreciate it, Jeff.
And we have another caller on the line?
Yeah, we got Stephen on the line right now from Bridgeport. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Steve.
And I'm just calling real quick to make a note about the credit card fraud. You guys asked people to call in, and I just recently had some credit card fraud on a debit card that's strictly only used locally at local mini-marts. This card does not get used anyplace else. and got two charges from France, about $195 a piece for books. So there you go.
They're getting very sophisticated.
You don't have to use a card online. I mean, it was local, you know, bodegas. It was the only place that card ever got used.
Yeah, well, the thing is to be diligent about all your purchases and maybe keep it off the line, you know?
Okay, have a great day, man. Yeah,
thanks for calling, Stephen. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.
Something I think that Jeff brought up, which I thought is really, really fascinating theory, is that these drones may have been Chinese, they may have been submarine launched. That's entirely possible.
And the fact that our FBI says they don't know what it is, the FBI is maybe telling the truth on that one.
Well, and Lockheed Martin and Boeing have both been trying to develop, for years an aircraft carrier based drone for the United States. It's entirely possible the Chinese have beaten us to it. And also, to answer your question about whether these things have to have markings or not, they don't necessarily. There was the CIA drone that was brought down, the RQ-170 that was brought down in Iran that had no markings on it. The only reason they knew it was one of ours was because nobody else had those kind of drones, and we admitted to it. After the drone was captured, the first people to get their hands on it were the Chinese. In addition, the stealth helicopter that was blown up near bin Laden's compound, the parts that the Pakistanis had that they captured from that helicopter intact, they sent to the Chinese. That was in the BBC. And Chinese scientists went to Iran to study the CIA drone that was brought down, the RQ-170. So it's entirely possible the Chinese can produce anything we develop. And not to mention, in connection with the credit cards and the hacking and everything, the Chinese can probably get in and view the blueprints that we have for all of this. So it's entirely possible that this was a Chinese drone, and that they are testing our defenses. Because let's face it, as much as we hoot and holler about, you know, if you fire a missile at us, we'll knock it out of the sky, the fact is that if the Chinese and Russians, we know they both have submarines off the U.S. coast. That's all open source. The Russians have a naval base in Venezuela, so they can resupply on their way up and down the U.S. coast. The Chinese submarines have been spotted off the U.S. coast. So, I mean, if they were to launch a strike either directly from the coast, and if they're just testing our defenses, we might never realize it.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., live public affairs call-in show, except for the first Monday of the month when our general manager, Steve, reports to the listeners. And we've been discussing the prospect of war over Korea, also the Alitalia jet that spotted a drone by JFK Airport, and about a phenomenon of credit card fraud, which is affecting a whole lot of people these days. You know, this Jeff's comment about the drone over JFK did bring to mind that 2010 missile launching off the coast of L.A., which our authorities claimed was a trail of a jet plane.
We have one call, gentlemen, by the way.
Independent investigator said was probably a Chinese submarine-based
missile. And I saw the video of it, and I can tell you as a military affairs analyst, it was ludicrous, the idea that it was a chemtrail. I've seen plenty of jet trails in my life. I've never seen one that looked like this.
And we have a caller, Del.
Yeah, if Ratbone is on the phone.
What was the name again, Del?
Ratbone, I know. It was interesting. Something on your mind?
Yes. I'm interested in the amount of energy that I see developed by you people, you know, looking at comtrails and trying to decide if drones can spawn other drones and all this stuff. And I would just like to make the suggestion, which is a little bit, I don't know what, but it's possible that you guys are just trying to, or just observing the deck chairs on the Titanic. I think all this stuff that's happening, these bad things that we all notice and, you know, get off on and observing and reporting and stuff, are just a function of the struggle between the 1% and 99%. The whole country thing is a shock. It's like, what is it, Brave New World, the three countries that fight each other and they change it around. People don't ever get to know. That's what's happening to us. I'd like to put that out there to you guys who obviously have spent a lot of time imagining the minutiae and understanding all this terrible thing and that terrible thing, and wondering if...
Well, we're not imagining it. It's real. We are a fact-based news reporting sort of outfit, too. And the commentary, by the way, I'm going to get this in, but in the commentary that goes on here is no reflection of WPKN.inc. This is... we have free wheels here. There's no suits looking over us, so, you know, free speech all about...
I'm just getting it in.
Go ahead.
You know, Carla, we talk a lot about the military. If I could just interject, because that 1% business you're talking about, is something we also talk about a lot here, because a big problem with this country and the overall thrust of our analysis of the military situation is that we put ourselves in a situation where we're devoting much too much of our resources to the military. We need, and I'm speaking really for myself, Ken McDermott Rowe, we need a new foreign policy that emphasizes just defense of this territory, and we need to reallocate our resources towards investment in this country so we start creating good-paying jobs, so that we end this crazy polarization of all the wealth in this country to the 1%. We've got to invest in the tradition of way back, like Abraham Lincoln with the Transcontinental Railroad. We've got to build up this country, create good jobs, and restore our middle class. And we ain't going to do that by sending our fleets all over the world and preparing for, you know, and provoking our foreign rivals. So I directly connect to what you say about 1% and this 99%. That's the real issue, is we want a better country for all Americans. And I don't see how sending our army, we're going to 35 countries in Africa in 2013, I don't see how that's going to create good jobs for Americans. They're going to benefit this country. So I'm really on the same wavelength with you, I think.
Well, empire can be very profitable if we make up our mind to be an empire. And I think that's one of the problems. You know, when you look at, like, the British Empire, for example, when the British went into India and when they went into Africa and things like that, the idea was, you know, eventually this empire, Britain was going to reap the resources, the empire was going to reap the resources, you were all going to be beneficiaries of the empire. Whereas we have the kind of love-hate relationship with the idea of being an empire. We don't want to be an empire because it's not a democratic principle, but then at the same time, we don't want the Chinese and the Russians having these resources, you know, and having dominance over us through these natural resources.
But this is, I think this is a policy for the 1%, this policy of expansion and seizing and devoting, allowing our economy hollowed out while we spend money trying to secure resources in Africa and prevent the Chinese from getting those resources. I say invest in the United States and build up a defense of this country so that nobody's going to mess with us. But focus here on a better standard of living for Americans.
Well, I mean,
and Ratbone, thanks for your call. Please.
Yeah, thanks,
thank
Ratbone.
You very much. Well, I mean, the thing is, I don't like the term 1% as much because I find it very divisive, because the idea of what makes the 1% is incredibly up to interpretation. I mean, if you're living, you know, I at one point in my life, you know, was a dishwasher and lived in a ghetto, you know, at that point.
Well,
when
let me
you,
just give you
that,
some numbers, Marshawn.
I got news for you. I still am.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a really good article, YouTube video you can see on this phenomena, which shows graphically that 1% of this country has 40% of the wealth here. Okay. And the bottom 80% of this country has only 7% of this wealth. And this has gotten really happened over the last generation. It's happened under Democrats and it's happened under Republicans. And it's a reflection of a really, I think, bankrupt public policy that's controlled by big corporations. I'm talking about the banks, the oil companies, the pharmaceutical companies, who are lining their pockets at the expense of the average American. And this isn't a left issue or a right issue.
It's an issue.
It's about us ordinary people against this corporate-controlled government that's exploiting us, not Democrat or Republican.
Now, so what do you all think about that? It's 203-336-9756. We've got about 10 minutes to go. We might as well stick on the subject and jobs.
Please give us
and
a
opportunity
call.
And 1%, 90% versus throwing out your money to the military, having the Chinese and everybody else hack our stuff, having the students come over here, take our secrets and go elsewhere. Not all of them, mind you. General overview, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the
we're asking for trouble.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, again, from a technical perspective, one of the things that's ridiculous is, you know, because I always hear people saying, oh, the sequester is going to be good. We're going to cut defense funding. Well, you know, the thing is, what we're cutting is we're cutting education for the soldiers. We're cutting food and water and ammunition. Like I say, butter, butter, jam for the soldiers, you know. But at the same time, we're still doling out billions to Lockheed Martin and Boeing. Look, the issue is not, you know,
it's the wrong way to spend money, in other words.
Exactly.
Because we need jobs here. We don't need necessarily to arm our military or to have them go all over the world, traipsing all over the place. We have this great technology. We learn satellite stuff. Fantastic. Always have. But how much of a percentage of our technology and money that's spent on this stuff goes elsewhere into evil and nefarious powers to work against us, let alone the sons of guns that we prop up everywhere across the world?
Well, and that's just it, too. I mean, in reality, if we wanted to have a strong national defense policy, first of all, we would have a large army, not, you know, a large defense industry, but a large army.
It's the wrong way to go.
We'd have tanks and planes and infantrymen. We would have, you know, the technology to defend our borders. We would have, you know, we would support, you know, our allies like Japan and South Korea, but we would be able, though, we'd be able to dissuade the Chinese from a war because they would know we'd have the resources to fight one. The other thing, too, is that, like I say, one of the biggest problems we have, the Russians have a policy, and so do the Chinese. Their armaments industries are all state-owned, but they say, you give us the product, then we pay you. What we do, and this is why we spend so much on defense, again, it's not pensions for soldiers that we spend so much on. What we spend the money on is we go to Lockheed Martin and Boeing, and we say, we want an aircraft carrier-based drone. And Lockheed Martin goes, okay, we'll get it to you, but first give us $300 billion.
Yeah.
Next year, we don't have it yet. Give us another $350 billion. And they keep tossing money at them, and that's what's bankrupting us. And the problem is that a lot of people, like, you know, like the administration, like President Obama, try to get people to connect, oh, it's soldiers' pensions that's causing us to go bankrupt. It's tuition assistance for the soldiers. It's disability for the soldiers. It's having soldiers, period. I mean, my favorite quote from Obama was, he said, you know, well, we had horses and bayonets in World War One. You know what? At the end of the day, every war throughout human history is decided by a soldier with a rifle and a bayonet. It's never, you know, the Germans had the greatest technology during World War II. They had the King Tiger tank. They had the first jet. They couldn't produce enough of them. They didn't have enough people. They didn't have enough soldiers. At the end of the day, technology is great, but it still comes down to spending your money sensibly and having soldiers.
It came down to the will of the people now, didn't it? Our soldiers at that time had more will, we wanted it more, and that's what we grew up in this country. I don't think we have that same desire.
We just have 7 minutes left. Another caller would like to weigh in on this. Give a ring at 203-336-9756. My name is Ken. I'm here with Marshawn Dindell.
But we covered a whole lot of topics there in that last couple of paragraphs, my friend.
Well, and I think you also raised a very interesting idea, which is national will, which is something that we as a society strongly lack. I mean, I was talking to my grandmother, who's 96 now, and she was telling me, you know, during the First World War, when war broke out, the young men lined up to go to war. They said, our nation's going to war. We're ready. Let's go.
The only thing we're lining up for are Social Security checks and welfare checks.
Exactly. And that's
job.
And the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans all know this. The Chinese, the Russians, and the North Koreans know that they can mobilize their whole population. They know if at the end of the day, if the American youth, because people, the American people right now are totally okay with sending soldiers overseas so long as it's just volunteers and they don't have to go. But if, you know, the call came out, listen, everybody over the age of 18 to 25 has to go to war, I think, you know, all those people who were lining up for the welfare checks would suddenly go, whoa, hey, time out, you know. I don't want to have to do this. And especially, like you say, what people want are jobs. They don't want a war. And, you know, we're in a very desperate, as a nation, socially, a very desperate situation. It's people don't have the stomach for a war right now. And the problem is that our enemies know this, which is why the Chinese view it as a very opportune moment. The North Koreans and the Russians do. And there's a Chinese philosopher, Li Su, who 2,300 years ago, famously said, you know, an opportunity comes once every 10,000 years. That's another thing. The Chinese have been around for a very long time. They've been watching history for a very long time. They, you know, they know their history.
Well, we need to have a debate in this country. We it seems since the end of World War II, we used to have a Republican Party in this country that was opposed to foreign intervention. And then sometimes during World War II, people like Robert Taft, they all fell by the wayside, Charles Lindbergh Sr., and there became this bipartisan pro-military expansion. Each party tries to outdo the other. We need to have a new debate in this country about why we have a military. Is it to project our power all over the world to control oil routes and oil fields, or is it to simply defend the United States while we put the rest of our resources in creating good jobs?
Well, I mean, your armaments industry can create good jobs, too, if the armaments are manufactured here. And that's another problem. Nothing is manufactured in the United States anymore. So, I mean, you have a problem on so many levels. And again, you know, I speak not from, you know, a pundit perspective, but just purely from a technical perspective, from a historical perspective, because that's, you know, that's what my expertise is in. You know, historically speaking, what we're doing is we're draining our work base. We're creating a generation of fundamentally white-collar only jobs. If you want to go into banking, if you want to go into, you know, the law or something like that, that's easy.
Yeah,
but if you're blue-collar...
Those jobs aren't easy to come by anymore.
Well, I agree. Yeah. But, I mean, what I'm saying, though, is that those are the jobs that we tailor to. Everybody's going to be a lawyer. Everybody's going to be a doctor. There is no job market anymore for the blue-collar folks, the GED, the high school grads. Those were originally all your factory employees, and that's fine. They made a good living.
And, you know, I was talking to a programmer who did very well for many years. He said about 10 years ago, those jobs started to disappear, and now the kind of work he did is all done by programmers in India. Well, God bless them, the guys in India. They deserve to live, too. But the American capital keeps flowing to the low-wage countries, leaving the American worker behind.
Exactly. And at the same time, we're ignoring our national defense as well. We're giving Homeland Security tanks, but our troops can't get tanks. We're giving $35 billion to Lockheed Martin and Boeing for something really idiotic, like an aircraft carrier-based drone, and yet we have to turn off the hot water at, you know, a major American military installation. So, I mean, the way our country's headed is completely, it's completely backwards kind of logic. But it has happened before. Like I say, and people need to be cognizant of this, this is why Germany invaded the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had a very, very strong military, yet as Stalin came to power, he built up the national security state. The NKVD, which later became the KGB, had an army bigger than that of the Red Army. They had an army better equipped than the Red Army. And Stalin killed off... Now, Obama fires a lot of his generals. Stalin killed them, so there is that little bit of a difference. But fundamentally, the issue of national suppressing domestic dissent became more important than keeping Russia's enemies outside.
This is where I think the so-called progressives in America, and I know a lot of listeners are progressives, need to stop giving this president a free pass. He has been attacking and undermining our civil rights. He has been engaging in just as bad a military expansion as Bush Jr. before him and Bush Sr., who kicked this whole thing off back in 1991 with the Persian Gulf War. People have to stop giving him a pass and hold him to the same test they would hold a Republican. And then we need to go back and start to really critically look at these guys. And if the man you like, if your foreign policy happens to be Republican, if his name is Ron Paul, well, I'll give him support. Get this debate going. Maybe give some support to Dennis Kucinich. Some of these people who are willing to question this bipartisan war fever that's really got the leadership of both of our parties under control.
Well, and war fever or otherwise, the fact is that it's almost impossible to tell the difference anymore between the two parties. I mean, and like I say, you know, the Democrats have in these recent years put forward more authoritarian measures than, you know, the NDAA, the drone, the domestic use of drones, everything, than the Bush administration did. And I think that's something we as a public need to be cognizant of, Republican or Democrat. People ask me what my political view is. I'm a nationalist. I'm not a conservative. I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal. I'm a nationalist. If a liberal comes up with a good idea, yeah, if a conservative comes up with a good idea, let's get that. I don't care whether it's John McCain saying we should get rid of torture or Dennis Kucinich saying we should have
honor the Constitution.
Yeah, I don't care. Because let's face it, I agree with McCain. We should get rid of torture. I agree with Kucinich on a lot of things. I agree with Ron Paul on a lot of things. But you know what? The problem is people are saying, well, I agree with so-and-so, but he's a Republican. I won't vote for him. Or I agree with so-and-so, but he's a Democrat. I won't vote for him. We need to look. We can't pick and choose. And we got to get rid of this party loyalty. This party loyalty. We're not the Soviet Union. Okay, we are a democratic
society.
Do we have
society. One call? I think we're just about to go off the air. Do we have a call? It's got to be...
We do have a call.
This has got to be quick. I'm sorry, sir, because we have to go off the air. Rick Petrone is coming up next with Jazz.
Sure. You ready?
Yeah,
sure,
go ahead.
Okay. I see the problem is that the middle class was asleep when we had that low interest rates and we all took out all those home equity loans and everybody was living beyond their means. So, in effect, the government and the non-representation and the jobs all going overseas, people were kind of complacent because they had all that free money. And if they hadn't, you know, if they'd looked at the accountant end of things, you would have been alarmed a lot more before the crash of the economy, because everybody would have realized we're living in an unsustainable...
That's right. That's right.
Man, there were a lot of desperate people out there, which is why they bought into this thing about refinancing. Everybody wanted a better deal, but, you know, how are we supposed to know that the mortgage rates that they were working on ended up coming from funny funds?
Thanks a lot for your call. Call back. We'll be on again next week at noon to 1 p.m., and we can continue our conversation. So thanks for calling.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. And stay tuned for Rick Petrone, who's coming up next with Jazz Sounds. And Dell, it's always a pleasure working you and Marshawn, Military Affairs Commentator.
Just to end on this note, it's not about Republican or Democrat. It's about what is best for the nation, what is best for the citizens of this nation. America first. That's what I say, America first. If it's not what's best for America, we got to leave it behind.
Till another time, gentlemen. Like next week.
Next week at noon.
We'll see you soon. Thanks for calling in, everybody.